This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Gargi from the New Books Network, and I have today with me Dr. Leela Neti. She is a professor at Oriental College, Los Angeles, and she is with me here today to talk about her new book, Colonial Law in India and the Victorian Imagination. Welcome, Dr. Neti.
Thank you so much, Gargi. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Like always, my first question is about the genesis of this book. Can you tell me what inspired you to write this book?
So I've always been interested in the law. When I was an undergrad, I was headed towards law school and I thought it would be a practicing attorney as a career. But I became much more interested in literature along the way and decided instead to pursue a graduate degree in English. But I never lost that interest in the law. And in particular, I was always fascinated by the ways in which law and literature seem to enable one another and often work in tandem with one another. And during the graduate school years, I was interested in questions of the South Asian diaspora in particular. And for example, I was interested in how indentureship contracts were sort of, you know, narratively constructed, or how the narrative of the contract itself was a kind of both legal and literary production or invention, right? And how in a lot of ways, the law was always a kind of act of imagination, and how conversely, literary texts often carried with them a kind of impetus towards creating norms or casting normative narratives. And so that intersection between sort of rules and literary production has always been sort of at the back of my mind. Incidentally, my grandfather was actually a lawyer in colonial India, and he had a collection of Moore's Indian Appeals, and that was my first introduction to that, you know, those volumes. And I would, you know, spend summers reading through some of those cases and always found them so fascinating because they really resonated with so many of our contemporary concerns as well. And this is something that I try to work out in the book as well, you know, the ways in which there are sort of these legal histories and legacies continue to haunt the narratives we cast in the present as well. Again, both literary and legal.
So. Yes, and this leads to the title of the book, because in one part is colonial law in India and the other is Victorian imagination. And you talk about diverse ways in which we could put these planes together. Can you talk about what are the major ways in which we can compare these two fields?
So, as the title suggests, the idea is to, and this is kind of a framework that I employ throughout the book, to read the law and literature alongside one another, and really to think about both the law and literature, again, as acts of imagination, right? The ways in which narrative, interpretation, questions of character and voice and analogy, metaphor, all of these things that we think of as sort of typically literary, really play a part in constructing the law as well. And especially the ways in which the law kind of becomes a narrative for organizing colonial life, right? So it in a way, the law is sort of the overarching construct that allows certain things to happen or not happen within, the scheme of colonial life. And the and in the title, right, the idea of colonial law and the Victorian imagination, it's really about how both of those two, both the law and literature, function in relation to one another. So as two distinct things, but also taken collectively as operating within a single kind of shared ideology, right? So both the law and literature, we can think of them both separately or individually, right? But we can also think of them as a kind of collective way of organizing and governing colonial life, right? And so, and central to both the law and literature is, of course, the idea of representation, right? The ways in which, the law and literature provide a mode of representation for colonial subjects and for their English counterparts. So how do you represent yourself? How do you seek representation? Again, I think the and is meant to do some double work there, right? As both, conjoining these two contexts, but also providing a kind of mechanism for separating them as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would like to go in the book. You are the cases you have taken from the JCPC, the Judicial Committee of Privy Council. For those not familiar with the colonial history of the subcontinent, could you tell us what was this and why was this so important in the colonial history of the subcontinent?
So the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council was created during the colonial era as the final court of appeals for colonial cases. And this was, of course, not just the subcontinent, but throughout the British colonial world. And in fact, the colonial the JCPC continues to hear cases from the Caribbean, even, up until the present moment, and from certain jurisdictions within the UK as well. So in particular, right now, they're sort of most relevant in terms of deciding some of the capital punishment cases arising from the Caribbean. And it's, of course, a kind of ironic legacy of colonial rule that capital punishment has been outlawed within the UK, but continues to exist in the Caribbean. And so the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council is still in kind of this odd position of, deciding cases that are in some ways very much legacies of that colonial encounter and the ways in which colonial law has been sort of grandfathered into Caribbean law in particular ways that it hasn't been in English law. So the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council actually was originally a kind of medieval institution, a group of advisors to the sovereign. And that emphasis on monarchical rule and, you know, forms of absolute sovereignty really kind of began to wane in Britain at roughly the same time as colonization gained ground, right? So what we see is that institutions like the JCPC found kind of a new life in the colonial environment where, you know, there was this sort of emphasis on a kind of absolute sovereignty where cases would be heard by a body within the colonial metropole in London, right? And the judges would have very little to do with the everyday life of the colonial subjects whose fate they were deciding. So, so there's this sort of model of sovereignty that's developing in the colonies that is happening concurrently with a very differently evolving mode of sovereignty that's happening in the UK at the same time, right? So what I suggest is that the JCPC was central to establishing these two historical trajectories, one that was sort of leading backward towards the medieval era in the colonies, and one that was, you know, in opposition to the simultaneous narrative that was leading forward towards modernity in the metropolitan context. So you know, the JCPC was sort of a crucial way of navigating that division between these two simultaneously unfolding legal histories that were working in opposite directions or moving towards opposite directions.
Does your research indicate why was this happening? Why is in one way, I mean, the sovereign is the same person, but why is this one hand you are going backwards or towards another system, and the other way you are going through absolutely the contrast of it? Why is this contradiction? Does your research indicate the reasons for this?
So within the UK, the movement was towards more of a parliamentary democracy model, right? Which was really a sort of distributing of sovereignty among the population. Whereas in India and in the colonies, there was much more a sense of a kind of vertical hierarchical model of sovereignty that was not invested in distributing, you know, power across the population. So I think, you know, the colonial model functions more efficiently as a kind of model of absolute sovereignty, where there is a sort of hierarchical vertical sense of rule. And so I think it's really just a question of the ways in which these two sort of forms of governmentality were in evolving in very different ways.
Okay. Now let's come to the literary part of this. And the book is analyzing these legal archives of the JCPC in what is said is a distinctively literary fashion. I mean, what could be the justifications for this approach? Is there a direct correlation between these literary works, or are there some indirect correlations? Could you talk a little about those?
So it's not so much that there's a direct correlation in the sense that they both involve the same historical material or anything like that necessarily, but the correlation is more thematic. So what I do is I select certain thematic concerns that are central to both the legal and the literary texts. And I read both archives in terms of, you know, the ways in which they approach those particular themes. So for example, in the case of something like Great Expectations and the legal case of Adel G. Byram G., the question of criminality is central to both of those two instances. And again, in terms of, you know, how I read these, I tend to read around that central issue of criminality, how did these two texts demonstrate, again, a kind of divergent pathway, right? So within the English novel, what we see happening is a notion of criminality that really revolves around a kind of individual guilt, right? The figure of Magwitch, who is, you know, the sort of unmistakably individual and quite, you know, characterful criminal. Versus in Adelgi, we have this sort of sense of collective criminality, right? And we see that carrying over again in the representation of criminality in Confessions of a Thug, for example, by Philip Meadows Taylor as well. So how does the sort of theme of criminality get represented in both of these two contexts? Again, you know, how does the Indian context take that idea of criminality and make it collective, right? So that we see Indian society as a whole being invoked as criminal, right? In the case of Adelji, we see Adelji along with 18 other criminal defendants being prosecuted for a single murder, right? So there's a sense of, you know, the crime not being the act of an individual agent, but rather a kind of collective, scene. We also see the punishment, right, unfolding as, you know, a spectacle of terror rather than as a kind of model of rehabilitation. So so I think the central concern was always, how does this theme play out differently in these two places? How does the fact of being a criminal in one context differentiate from the fact of being criminal in another context, right? Is there a different meaning associated with the idea of the criminal based in these two places, right? And so how is that meaning constructed? Again, is it narrative? Is it, you know, is the idea of a criminal itself always a particular narrative? Is it always a fiction? Is it always a matter of legal fact, right? These were the kinds of questions that were always of interest to me.
And what was it? I mean, could we make a generalization here and say that in England, there is criminality is very individualized, and in the subcontinent, it's not the case? I mean, could this generalization be, can it hold true?
I think so, yeah. I think that, you know, in not only the cases that I looked at, but in the, you know, literary representations as well, there's a general sense that the Indian criminal, and we see this, you know, even in collective criminality at the current moment, right, in terms of the ways in which criminality is racialized, you know, to include larger communities, right, in the United States and elsewhere, the assigning of guilt to collectives is very different in the racialized context, even in the present moment, than it is in terms of sort of the specificity of the singular culprit, right? That is the kind of cornerstone of the, you know, the Western legal kind of principle, right? But that doesn't always play out when we talk about criminality within a kind of racialized context.
Yes. There are two novels where the Great Expectations, and then there's a novel of Philip Meadows Taylor. And I imagine this book was also written for the English audience. It's written in English. Do you think this was maybe a sociological project of preparing the colonizers for the kind of violences that would actually happen, how did this play out for the readers who would be reading something like Confessions of a Thuggy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Confessions of a Thug was an enormously popular book. It was read by everybody, including Queen Victoria herself. So it really was a very well-received novel. It's kind of you know, disappeared from the canon over the intervening centuries, and very few people, I think, read it now. But, you know, this is an example of exactly what I was talking about a moment ago in terms of the very word thug, right? The way in which it has a kind of association with racialized criminality, even now. It originates from the Indian context, you know, the idea of the thug who practiced, you know, a form of hereditary criminality that was discovered by, you know, a colonial administrator, W.H. Sleeman, and assigned to a group of, you know, hereditary, you know, what he called thugs, right? The hereditary criminal. And in the book, Meadows Taylor describes sort of armies numbering in the thousands of these thugs. And of course, you know, Radhika Singha has, for example, done a great deal of research on the history of thuggy and the sort of problematic conclusions that Sleeman reached. But in Confessions of a Thug, there's very much a sense of the ever-present threat of Indian criminality. And on the one hand, that was localized in India for the British reading public. But on the other hand, by virtue of the novel, it became a very intimate fear for the British readers themselves as well, right? So the idea that, you know, the Indian criminal was everywhere within the intimate spaces of their own imaginations, right? That, I believe, began to seep into a kind of cultural fear, right? To produce a kind of cultural fear of, you know, the spectacle of Indian criminality and the ways in which that criminality was just sort of everywhere. And in Sleeman's narrative as well, you know, was impossible to it was always impossible to tell who might be a thug, right? That it could be anyone. It was a secretive cult. It was a, you know, the thugs could be drawn from any ranks of Indian society. They could be Hindu, Muslim. There was really no distinguishing characteristic that might identify a thug to, you know, the British viewer. So, you know, I think this worked to create the idea that Indian criminality was sort of a universal aspect of Indian society at large, and the thug could really be anywhere, and it could be anywhere, anyone at any time. So I think that general sort of sense of fear became a defining characteristic of, you know, interaction between the British reading public and the idea of the Indian as such.
If we move on to the second case, which is an 1863 case, you have mentioned an interesting quotation by John Stuart Mill, who is an English philosopher and a member of the British Parliament, and his views on Hinduism. I'm interested to know why was he interested at all in religion of the subcontinent.
So I think that was actually James Mill, but it was James Mill's History of British India, and I think that's the one that you're referring to. But I'm not positive on that.
Let's go on and I'll check back on this. And let you know.
No problem. But yeah, I mean, James Mill wrote the History of British India as a kind of justification for British rule, British colonization in India. And, you know, one of the sort of main premises of the history, which on the one hand was intended to be expository, right, to reveal something and to, you know, tell a series of facts, a history in that concept of it. But at the same time, very much produced a narrative, right? Was always a fiction in and of itself. And so the history of British India represented Indian society as sort of invariably incapable of producing a viable modernity, right? So again, going back to this idea of the two divergent notions of history, within Mill's representation, Indian history was always sort of tainted at the outset so that it could never move forward. It would always inevitably move backward, right? So there was a sort of backward leaning trajectory mapped out for Indian history by Mill and by other sort of Orientalist historians, right? That would represent the subcontinent to itself, right? So for many Indians also reading Mill's history, right? There was a sense of the kind of facticity of the history, which obviously has been contested over the years. But for the British reading public, again, produced a kind of reality, right? And that reality was very much a kind of a representation that lent itself to being intervened in. So the sort of inevitable deterioration of Indian society necessitated colonialism as a kind of intervention to, you know, reroute Indian history into modernity as a kind of charitable kind of intervention, right? So again, it became a kind of justification for why colonialism was necessary and the ways in which it was able to, you know, reroute history into modernity when otherwise it was headed directly backward.
Yeah, you're right. This is my mistake. I confused the two. This is about James Mill. But James Mill book is different. How do you think it was being read generally as compared to a novel within the British public at that time? Or do you think this was more of a specialized literature, which is now relevant for post-colonial societies, but wasn't at the time?
I think it was popularly read and served a really sort of foundational role in representing India to British readers. So I think that, you know, it wasn't a world in which they could obviously turn on the news and you know, and access a kind of 24-hour coverage. So they depended much more on books to gain a kind of familiarity with a place, right? And so I think that Mill's text was instrumental in creating certain ideas about India that were then filtered into the various narratives that that represented India. So whether those were legal or literary narratives, they, you know, again, kind of arose from a same shared kind of ideology about India. And Mill's text was one of the kind of fundamental foundational texts that made that vision possible.
I would like to now come back to the case, which is Ramaswamy Iyer versus Venkatesh Achari, where the book claims that it reshaped Indian temporality and history. Can you tell us what you mean by reshaping Indian temporality and history?
So in that case, it was a sort of centuries-long dispute between various competing sects of temple priests and, you know, their rights to perform certain religious services at the temple. And one of the kind of hallmarks of this, the way in which this case evolved over its years of litigation is that the various courts considered different historical evidence in each iteration, right? So that in one iteration, the court was willing to consider sort of, you know, a long kind of almost folkloric or mythological rendition of events. In another iteration, the court, and this is sort of the iteration that I focus on, the court set a historical date and said, we will only consider, you know, the narrative beyond this particular historical date. And so in setting a particular historical date and considering the narrative from that date forward, that had the effect of normativizing a particular notion of time and its relationship to narrative that made possible only a particular conclusion. So the way in which the narrative was situated temporally and the kinds of evidence that were allowed into the narrative based on a particular understanding of history worked to shape the outcome of the opinion, right, of the decision. So how we view history in some sense determines the kinds of narrative conclusions that we can reach. And that was kind of the point that I was making in that particular instance.
And why were they so divided if the conclusions of the court case was linked to the temporality, the timeline, so as to say, why were they constantly divided over this line?
So this particular case was a little bit complicated in the sense that it had gone back and forth many times. So there were a series of appeals, and the outcomes were not consistent between them. So depending on which outcome you started with, you would have a different sort of narrative. The sort of crucial part about this particular case was that. I'm just glancing at the book, but was really the idea that religious time and historical time were again presented as kind of two different concepts, right? So the argument that I'm making broadly is that Indian time was relegated to religious time, and British colonial time was seen as occupying the space of historical time, right? So really what ended up happening in the cases was that British temporality sort of arbitrarily set the beginning point, right? And what ended up happening was that there was a kind of neutrality assigned to the historical conceptions of the judges, right? So that colonial law was put in a position to solve the problem of Indian historical time, right? And to solve the problems that arose out of the muddled nature of religious time. And so the muddled nature of religious time, again, sort of along the same lines as Mill's argument, could only result in a kind of, a backward looking sort of a religious temporality, right? Whereas legal historical time could extricate the solution out of that muddled religious time and reorient it towards a more sort of modern, real or fact-based notion of time, right? So it's not so much that the two narratives, it's not so much that the Indian narrative and the English narrative were always at odds with one another. It's just a question of how the judges sort of represented their own interventions as creating English time as the time of modern legal solutions and Indian time as the time of, again, backward, inevitably religious, kind of mythological or folkloric time. If that makes sense.
Definitely does. You compared this to Wilkie Collins' novel, The Moonstone, which is also based in the subcontinent and the defeat of Tipu Sultan. I would like here to talk a little about the interesting quotation which you have used about Todorov and the detective novel. And I would like to quote, you say the teleology of the detective novel inevitably works to ensure that the detective and the society affected by the crime remain above the fray. Likewise, the judicial acts I discuss in this volume occupy a similar position of immunity. Can you elaborate a little, which does lead back to what you just talked about, the difference in time and what the judges are doing?
Yeah, this relates both to what I was saying just a moment ago and also to the point that I was making earlier in terms of, you know, the collectivity of Indian criminality and the individuality of British criminality or English criminality. And so one of the points that Todorov makes is that there is a kind of neutrality or you know, the reading public is sort of implicitly innocent, right? And that is by virtue of the fact that they are reading to decipher the individual guilt of the particular criminal, right? And so if the criminal is an individual, everybody else reading the detective novel must be, you know, implicitly innocent, right? And so that, I argue, created a kind of notion of social or collective innocence for the British reading public, right? That was, again, very different from the kind of collective criminality of the Indian subject. So the idea of the reading public being neutral, right, or in some sense objective, this is a really, I think, close analogy to the way in which the JCPC also functioned, right? So the judges of the Judicial Committee were in London, again, far removed from the lives of the cases that they were considering, and often using forms of law with which they had no familiarity, right? So, you know, local laws in India or Nigeria or Kenya or anywhere else, right, throughout the empire, really had no kind of personal significance to the justices on the Judicial Committee. And yet they were governing over these cases as though they were sort of able to objectively decide the law, right? But of course, the law is itself always a narrative, and the interpretive strategies of the law are also always narratively produced. So, so what we have is this sort of ironic way in which the justices view themselves and are viewed socially as kind of neutral or objective readers, right? But what I argue is that in fact they are writers as well, right? So they're not simply consumers of these texts, these legal texts, but they're also authoring opinions that really shape the lives of the characters that they're reading about, right? So in a way, they're writing the narrative that becomes the kind of script of colonial life. And so it's not a sense in which, as Todorov is describing, right, that there is, and he obviously is critical of this notion too, but it's not a sense in which they're simply bystanders, but they're also sort of producers as well.
I would like to come back and the ethical implications of this, but to move on to the third case, For those who are not very familiar with the subcontinent, may not be aware of how important adoption was a theme in the colonial rule of the British. I've always been curious why is this such an important theme? Can you tell us why that's the case?
So adoption was particularly important in the case of local rulers who local sovereigns who died without natural born heirs. So during the height of colonial expansion, in particular, there was a doctrine known as Dalhousie's Doctrine of Lapse, which essentially said that any local sovereign who died without a natural, a biological heir, right, male heir, would cede their territory to the colonial state. So adoption was critical to preserving lines of inheritance or contesting lines of inheritance, as the case may be. And, you know, who could inherit property and how and under what conditions was central to thinking about questions of adoption and the ways in which adoption rights were curtailed over the course of imperial rule. So, you know, if adoption was once a viable mechanism for inheriting sovereign rights and territories, colonial rule intervened in that. And what I suggest is that this had kind of financial implications and, of course, you know, political implications, but it also had implications within the affective realm, right? Kinship, love, affection, these were all impacted by the way in which adoption was governed under colonialism.
And for this, you take the example of Begum Sumru, who's a very fascinating character. Can you tell us a little about her and why is she a person of interest here?
So she was, you know, one of these local sovereigns who had a territory in northern India outside of Delhi. And she was quite powerful and quite an interesting figure. Often described, you know, as sort of masculine in her appearance and in her interactions with the colonial government, and so she was a sort of interesting figure for a lot of reasons, you know, questions of gender and sexuality, questions of political intrigue, in terms of the kinds of treaties and alliances that she formed with the colonial state, but also because she inherited her own territory from her partner, Walter Reinhardt, who again was a kind of mercenary who acquired his property, through his own sort of personal dealings with the local Indian sovereigns. And so she administered this large territory and was not, did not have a biological heir. And so she attempted to will her property to her adopted son, who was actually, a descendant of Walter Reinhardt biologically, but was within her own lifetime sort of important to her as a kind of adopted son. And the British state sort of, the colonial state intervened and sort of dismantled the adoption rights of her son to inherit her territory and took over the land themselves. So she was sort of both a really compelling figure, but one who was ultimately very tragic in the outcome of her son's sort of struggle. There was a long legal struggle to regain control of the territory. He moved to England, ultimately was married into British high society and, shortly thereafter diagnosed as mad. And he died a very, very sad life in the end. So she was, ultimately quite a tragic figure.
And you compare this case with Eliot's Silas Marner. Can you tell us a little on why did you choose this novel to compare with Begum Sumru?
So what I wanted to show was a sense of how Eliot's novels, many of which feature kind of adoption as a central theme, the ways in which adoption is represented in almost purely affective terms within the space of the British novel, right? So much more sympathetically and as serving sort of the goals of kinship and affection rather than sort of financial or political aims, as was always sort of the implicit narrative within the Indian legal cases, right? So, you know, Samru's affection for her child was never really, you know, at the forefront of these British legal cases, right? It was much more about sort of, you know, the political aims and gains, right? Whereas for the British reading public, there was much more of an emphasis on adoption as a kind of sign of affection. But what I also wanted to show was the way in which within Eliot's novels, you know, Daniel Deronda in particular, right, we see a kind of failure of adoption and of kinship and you know, so forth as well, to sort of satisfy those goals. And so in a lot of ways, Samru is kind of a departure from the overall trajectory of the book, which kind of maps out sort of the ways in which colonial law routed Indian acts as kind of, you know, stunted, right? And in this instance, Samru provides a kind of alternative to even somebody like Eliot's characters in her capacity to sort of envision adoption along different lines or more progressive lines than some of Eliot's characters are ultimately able to do. So I wanted to present kind of a sense of complexity, right? That it wasn't always that the British novel sort of provided an escape route for, you know, for its own British characters, while the colonial law sort of rendered the Indian subject somehow voiceless, right? And so I wanted to sort of complicate that narrative as well.
This comparison between the literature and the practice of justice is for me inherently very critical of the justice that is being practiced, because it seems as if that the GCPC is creating narratives, is creating norms that do not correspond to the realities, and is really about things that do not have any source in the society that it is being practiced. Is this interpretation correct, or am I far away from what you were trying to say?
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I mean, this goes back to the idea that the JCPC was really, you know, sort of deciding cases that really had no kind of real life bearing on their own worlds, right? So there was a kind of, you know, sense of being removed from the action, which, you know, was interpreted as a kind of, you know, as lending a kind of authenticity or objectivity to the rulings. But I think, you know, the other kind of important point to consider is that what we take to be fact is already a process of interpretation, right? So, you know, the kind of facts of a case, and this is kind of the point I was trying to make earlier too, about where you start the historical narrative, right? The facts are already produced contextually. There's not really, I think, a sense of a fact that can be extricated from a narrative, right? So the facts themselves emerge out of a complex network of narratives, which include things like, you know, Mill's History of British India, right? Or the various novels that, you know, that represent India, like Confessions of a Thug, or, you know, the JCPC's own interactions, maybe personally, with colleagues who have been in India. So there's always a context for what the JCPC would have taken to be fact. And so it's not that somehow the justices were acting neutrally, as they would have us believe, right? They were always already kind of part of a narrative context that guided their own opinions in a particular direction. And so to the extent that their own opinions emerged out of this narrative context, what I would call a literary context, they were always sort of, they were as guided by the narrative presuppositions of their own ideological formation as they assigned, in some sense, to the Indian cases they were deciding, right? So their own kind of ideological subtext always guided the opinions that they were ultimately able to generate.
And this leads very nicely to my last question, because even contemporary subcontinent society is called very Victorian in the sense that we are constantly redefining our time and redefining what we are. And this we see in several countries of the subcontinent and not just India. And it does lead to this ethical considerations of, for example, in India, if not to mention the most controversial, I mean, roads and cities are constantly being renamed because of a history that is prior, which is true history, but which is and which undoes in some way the aggressions of a particular community, of a particular religion. And is this also related to the colonial as if the, when the British left, they inherently made us adopt some of the practices of the colonial rule. Is this linked, or do you think this this may also have other reasons for being there?
Yeah, I mean, I think history is always a kind of layering of narratives on top of one another, and it becomes really difficult to distinguish at a certain point, you know, the origins of a particular factor of history, right, or product of history. So is, you know, is the current, you know, government in India a product of colonial rule or of, you know, a resurgence of Hindu nationalism? It's, you know, all of those things are, I think, intertwined in particular ways, right? And it's very difficult to sort of, I think, parse out which aspects of contemporary society are products of colonialism and which are parts of, you know, other elements. To what extent are they always, you know, interwoven with one another from the outset? I'm not sure if that's answering your question, but I think that...
No, it does, because many historians, when they counter Hindu nationalism, they would go back and say, well, you took this from a colonial discourse, like, for example, a British person says it, and that's why you're claiming that this is a, this belongs to a particular community and not the other. So, for example, you wouldn't find in texts which are not in English, which are written in different languages. And I'm imagining that this is also our inheritance of the Victorian time that in some ways still lives on in the subcontinent. Or would you say that's not the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that search for origins is in a way a kind of, you know, a search for kind of faulty origins is also a kind of legacy of Victorianism, right? The sort of lingering effects. And, you know, just as the Victorians got a lot wrong, I think contemporary, you know, contemporary efforts to sort of look back to some sort of golden past, right, are often misreading the history that they're claiming. And so, you know, this an instance of this is something that I discuss in the book in terms of the temple doors of Somnath in Wilkie Collins's text, right? The sort of, you know, the ways in which the novel kind of rewrites the story to focus on Tipu Sultan, but in the ways in which sort of contemporary Hindu nationalists have kind of claimed those origins of the temple, legacies and so forth, right? And so, you know, of course, there's always misrepresentations, and the extent to which we can blame them on the Victorians, I think, you know, it's not something that I'm really, a specialist in determining. But I think that sort of methodology of searching for origins and using sort of dubious interpretive strategies to arrive at them is definitely a legacy of the Victorians.
Yeah. I would always like to end with knowing about your future projects. What are you working on? What can we expect from you to read?
So I'm currently working on a book project that reads contemporary post-colonial fiction alongside kind of 19th century and onward legal cases. So I look at how these colonial legal formations are kind of still present in contemporary fiction, but also in contemporary law as well. So that's kind of the next project that's very much in its kind of nascent stages.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being there and talking to me. And I look forward to read more from you.
Thank you so much, Gargi. It was a pleasure speaking with you.